You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore. Well, I want to welcome here today for Sound Poetry, Bill Kpinser of the University of Puget Sound and formerly Poet Laureate of Tacoma in 2008 and 9.
That's correct.
Welcome to the Sound Poetry of Radio Tacoma, Bill.
Thank you so much for having me, David.
Bill has a T-shirt that says, "No Fracking Way." And in that light, I know of some of his poetry is very contemporary, politically, environmentally sharp, acute in attacking some of the desecration of the Indian lands and waterways. And so take it away, Bill, and read us some poetry.
All right. So thank you, David. And before I start, I would like to do something that folks are increasingly doing, which is to make a lands acknowledgement and to acknowledge that we're on the traditional lands of the Puyallup Nation, where there has been a great culture here for thousands and thousands of years, and that we're guests on that land. And often land acknowledgements stop there. And I've been feeling really compelled to take that a step further and to think about what it means to be a guest in someone else's home, especially such gracious and generous hosts as the Puyallup Nation are. For me, at least, that means standing up against things that I see happening that are so obviously wrong, and it means standing up to a history of violations of treaties and of broken promises. So most recently, that involves the construction of a liquid natural gas facility, which Puget Sound Energy is building down on the tide flats, which is some of the most sacred of the traditional lands of the Puyallup tribe. I'll talk a little bit about some of the reasons this is a terrible thing, but a short list would be that it exacerbates global climate change because methane, which is the main gas involved, leaks. It poisons the water of communities that are often communities of poor folks and also indigenous communities. And it's built on land where it was not invited to be built. It's also built near the ICE facility where people who are imprisoned solely because of their immigration status, don't have a way to get away from disasters that are, I think, actually a very, very significant risk. So with that preamble, often when I'm out and involved in some sort of event or activism, someone will invariably come up to me and say, "What's LNG?" I'm going to dedicate this poem to all of the middle-aged men who've come up to me to ask me something that they already know. What's LNG? Leaking noxious ghastliness. Leave nothing growing. Looked nicer green. Lahar zone, NWDC, geological fault. Land not given. Looting native graves. Lushoot seed names grieve. Last natural gooey duck. Laughable notification given. Legacy of 9 grifters. License never granted. Living near gangsters. Leave neighbors gasping. Long-term negative growth. Livelihoods now gone. Legal nightmare grows. Leaching neighbors' groundwater. Lessons never grasped. Love not greed. Love not greed.
An acronym gone crazy. Yes.
Yeah.
Do you know of the Beehive Collective?
I do not. I do not believe I do. Mm.
They also did artwork, graphic artwork, and spoke against LNG, especially the Astoria port that was planned. And
yeah.
BARC in Northwest is also an organization that is protesting quite often in the woods against the lines that they plan to build.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. I mean, it's terrible and it's tragic how much natural gas exploration and piping there is all over the Northwest. So the legacy of nine grifters, if that maybe was the one reference I might have explained, nine is the number of city council members that we have. And right now, all but one of our city council members is funded by oil industry, specifically Puget Sound Energy and also some others. I have two poems that are written in form that are about local environmental issues. And I like writing in form because it takes some of the decisions away. Mm-hmm. And this is an older form called a villanelle, where the lines kind of cycle back and forth. And it's titled Villanelle for Villains. The earth beneath our feet keeps changing tactics, shifting as the sea recalls the sand. You want to live, they call you a fanatic. PSE sees green in shilling fracked gas, pumped from poisoned wells on stolen land. The earth beneath our feet keeps changing tactics. Tacoma City Council members, back this backyard bomb. Constituents be damned. We want to live, they call us all fanatics. Water warriors rise, activists get active. In solidarity, we make our stand, steadfast protectors, ever-changing tactics. Puyallup salmon breach endangered status as Keystone spirits battle corporate scam. You want to live? They call you a fanatic. Dennis McLaren gets a call from Kimberly Harris. Why is LNG not moving as we planned? The earth beneath their feet has changed its tactics, where living waters gather, furious and fanatic. Kimberly Harris is the CEO of Puget Sound Energy, and she made, I think, $7.6 million in 2018. And I don't know if you have gas service in your home. Many of us do, because we, you know, when we moved in, it was what was there. But there's been a massive series of rate increases. I think it was 14.9%, somewhere in the 14 range in November. And PSC is now asking for another rate increase. Mm. They'll be asking for more. That's their next ask is going to be to ask the Washington Utilities and Trade Commission to have Tacomans pay for about $133 million of a $310 million facility that doesn't give any benefit to people. It's a commercial enterprise. So that's why she's mentioned there. And I mentioned Dennis McLaren because he is an attorney who used to be the head of the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency, and guess which corporate board he sits on right now?
This is really, I have no idea.
Puget LNG, which is the shell corporation that was created to run the LNG scheme.
Well, so that was a very acute word used in tactics with the changing plates, tectonic.
Yeah,
hint at the problems that can come. Mm-hmm. From nature's shifting dynamics.
Yeah.
And to have a plant right on a waterway, a huge waterway by rivers, incredible.
Yeah, and that wasn't even where the LNG plant is actually, was not land until, you know, fairly, I mean, it's still not land. That whole estuary was one of the most beautiful and rich and vibrant estuaries in the world, where, you know, there were shellfish and fish, you know, moving through, and seabirds and all sorts of marine plants. And in a very short time, colonial culture has reduced it to, I think there are 27 Superfund sites there now. Those are, you know, the designation for a site that's so toxic it requires government cleanup. This might be a good place, actually, to read another poem of mine that's titled Puyallup Estuary. And I wanted to dedicate this poem to the water warriors, to the indigenous activists who are really leading the way and teaching us and inspiring the movement to protect life on this planet. I mean, that's really what the stakes are. It's that simple. Do we want to have a future where everyone's children can live and have a, a peaceful and just life. And that's what I think all of this in the end is really, really about. When I'm looking through my poems, I'm reading them here on the computer, and I save the different versions, you know, with some sort of number to remind myself of which version it was. But with the poem I just read, Villanelle for Villains, I had to change the end of the poem. It used to say, Macquarie's Nick Moore rings Kimberly Harris, and the Macquarie Group is the big multinational corporation headquartered in Sydney, mm-hmm. Australia. That's it's really sort of rapacious company that used to have a majority stake in Puget Sound Energy, but they've since sold it to a consortium of retirement funds, mostly Canadian, although I think there's one Dutch there. So my, I always think of the corporate structure as being sort of like a mutating cancer cell, and my poem has to sort of evolve its immune defenses. So this is the other poem that I'm going to read today that's in a form, and it's a sestina. So I think of it as almost like a braided, almost like a, you know, a braided piece of rope or a woven piece of fabric or a basket. And I think you'll hear those N words, those repetons come back again. So Puyallup Estuary for the Water Warriors. In the bay, everything returns. Kelp bends to waves, fleeting words, then turns its yearning southward soon as water brims the shore. So too, unmoored life. Salmon track the scent of ancestors. Heron chart stars. Orcas circle the Salish Sea as legends circulate, evolving so when tale at last returns to teller's ear, it is the ancestors who through a stranger's rough-hewn words reveal their familiar selves. If life leapt from the sea, it's fitting that to water we should in fits return. And so the waterfront revs and throbs, the traffic circle clogged with preening cars, bay choked with boats, young life. When reincarnation served, I'll take my turn in any cast-off shell that can skip leeward over youth's brash certainty that ancestors have nothing new to say. What would those ancestors think of this scene upon the water? I can't say. Nor have I yet found words equal to the threat of the concentric circles the port commissions painted on our back. I turn toward the LNG refinery, a shrine to life rendered into fumes of profit, life drained, filled, and flensed. Ancestors denied the just and natural return of fins and fronds and bones to living water, living air, and living soil, a circle broken sure as greed shears sense from words. I walk on ground that colonizers' words have poisoned. Yet injured land still harbors life. Dead language hides truth's embers. Encircled by cupped hands and breathed to light, ancestral spirit liberates the slag heaps. Water protectors greet us prodigal kin returning to hold the circle by these sacred waters, where we keep to living beings our human word until we join Earth's ancestors in our turn.
You're hearing some radical poetry that goes deep to the roots of the Native Indian peoples and their concern for sacred waters. Bill, you also, in your Anthropocene poetry, though you've come to the perfect place to work more deeply on that, in that vein, you came from Tulsa at one time where
I did.
Oklahoma is known as a fracking land and a oil land. Did you get your early influence to protest and to write inflammatory works?
That's a good question. I think actually my interest in the human relationship to the environment, which is just to say the thing that we're all part of and that I want to recognize. I grew up in the Northeast. I grew up in Connecticut in a small town, and was lucky to be able to spend time just kind of running around in what was still and still is some pretty beautiful and self-determining woods. I think of one of the things that's most important about thinking about land and the beings of the natural world is to think about their own sense of autonomy, and that we're not the central perspective of we being humans of everything. So I was fortunate to get the chance to have kind of hands-on experience with that. But I did move to Tulsa. That was my first job when I got out of grad school. So I taught at the University of Tulsa for 3 years. And Tulsa is a really beautiful place in many ways. It is also a place that oil has been a big industry for a long time. Fracking was really just getting underway after I left. But I know, from news reports and from talking, with folks who are still there, that one recent year, didn't Oklahoma have the most ground tremors, earthquakes in the continental U.S. And that was certainly not the case before. That's all fracking related, and it kind of makes sense. If you're going to inject millions of gallons of proprietary chemicals into holes you drill deep in the ground so that you can loose these gases and all these fossil fuels. Natural gas it's fracked gas, right? It's a fossil fuel, just like oil, just like coal. If you look at the life cycle of it, it's absolutely no better. There's nothing cleaner about it. And many things suggest that its impact on the climate is much worse. So I was writing about some of those things. I think I have a poem in that book from 11 or so years ago, Fallow, that talks about the refining industry in Tacoma. There's actually some poems about fracked gas in there as well. I wrote the first poem that I wrote about fracked gas in about 2006 when I went up to Maine to do some camping. And in Passamaquoddy Bay, I encountered the start of a fight over a big proposed LNG project. And actually the place that was staying, an engineer was staying there too, who was out there to do that work and gave me his side of things, which I quickly learned was very incomplete and often misleading a set of facts. So.
Well, lest people think you're a mineralogist or a geologist, you have also some deep interest in botany. In fact, many of the botanical poems do show some of the charms and the curses that came with human beings' mishaps in the planting of right. gardens and forests.
I think I know which poem.
Would you read your introductory one on the mole plants? That one hits the spot there.
Yeah, this is an older poem. I wish I could tell you the exact year. When I read this poem, I sometimes will say that among the things in my life I'm not proud of is introducing an invasive species of plant to southwestern Connecticut, and that probably gives you most of what you need to know. The only other thing is that Poverty Hollow Road is a real place in Redding, Connecticut. It's a rural part of the state. Mole plants. One must be ever vigilant against the claims of roadside hucksters, backwoods mountebanks, snake oil men seen from Sunday car rides deep along Route 7. One must mind the small pockets of commerce sprung between the stern hills and disapproving inns, gifts and secondhand antiques, nurseries guarded by sleek coils of hose, fields of greenhouse stocked with azaleas, hydrangeas, orchids, slips of promise all. Beyond the exotics tented with heat. And stranger claims still, like a lie so peculiar it has to be true, the mole plant. I read the tag, Euphorbia letheris, saw a calculus of facing leaves, their green a glimpse of Pliocene, atavistic as the moles that fear them. I imagined old adversaries revisiting a half-forgotten feud of burrowing roots, tendril digits, an alkaloid bite to send you scamping. I bought the entire tray and took the nurslings home to Poverty Hollow Road, set 10 around my garden, but saw no place for more. I drove them the next town over to my mother and father's house. After supper, we walked to my station wagon, where I presented the wisps of natural cure-all, extolled their imagined virtues, I am sure. This was 6, 7 years past, a breezy season, not like this summer of nuclear tests and swelter. Poverty Hollow's long gone, but not my folks' house, not the moles, certainly not the mole plants, which grew into something I could never have imagined. Pastoral verse with a sinister twist. The plants thrived, flowered, shot out seed pods, revealed unthinkable innovations, grotesque dehiscences. They made short work of the yard, mole plants shading the doorstep, mole plants lining the drive, mole plants threatening the blackberries, mole plants vying with mole plants displacing all. And the moles, perhaps they reached some accommodation. Earth tunnels crossed the yard, though not so many as might. It may be that someone read the name wrong. Mistranslation, false friends, moles never knew mole plants, are indifferent as language and nature are to the insufficient word that would span them. Now, for 2 days, I have uprooted mole plants. Back, bent against the soil, gloves brittle with their milky sap, I've snapped their stems, piled them high, doused their roots with salts, and still they linger, bringing me to my knees, colonizing my dreams, leading me to the moment when prayer begins.
Thank you for reading that one.
Thank you for inviting me.
In your poetry, you do employ serious language of the arts and sciences. Dehiscences, for example, in the poem that you just read. You used the Latin botanical term for the plant. Do you think of using some words in your poems as ways of sending people to the lexicon for an education?
I like words, and the fact that we have so many available is a great richness of the particular language that by accident I find myself writing in. But yeah, to answer your question, I mean, I think each one of those words kind of came in through its own way. And there were poets when I was starting to write who I really admired, partly for their, apt and often unexpected word choice. So Seamus Heaney was a big favorite of mine.
His words are unusual.
Absolutely.
Made up.
And there's something about that, the way that he fits them into this rhythm, which has this, you know, really very kind of organic quality to it that just feels right. So I guess my goal would be to find the word that feels right. I think that I'm less likely these days to, you know, kind of, I don't know if I would put dehiscence in that poem if I read it today
is so onomatopoetic of the spreading of the pods and the seed.
It has like the, I think of it as dehiscence. I think the beginning of the word is like the seed pod cracking open, and then after that, maybe the dispersion of the of the seed. So
flints that you used before also is an interesting kind of scissor-like word of cutting.
Yeah.
Too.
Yeah. I mean, it's a word that I think of as being connected with whaling, right? Which you know, is a subject that has a very different history for, you know, for indigenous whalers for whom that's part of a sustainable and longstanding cultural tradition. And when I was thinking of the word in that, this poem, I was thinking of how those kind of traditions get turned into not a tradition, but into an industrial form of resource extraction. So that was where I was thinking of flints as doing things in an unsustainable way that had been done in a sustainable and reverent way for many, many thousands of years.
Correct. Why don't you go back to some of the chosen ones that you want to read?
Sure. Yeah, so anyway, so this is another form poem. It's a huzzle, a form that comes from the Arabic world, often connected with song, but it's also a kind of dramatic monologue
in which Persian poetry was rich in ghazals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm performing a role addressed to my constituents. The status quo's objectives mold my votes as city councilor. Corporate rapport just makes me a more effective city councilor. My amorous epistle to that fracked gas factory. Thing is, my memory has grown selective as city councilor. Same goes for my fraternizing with grim industry. Each glass of Merlot finds me a more connective city councilor. You say my facts are off the mark? LNG sears earth buenqui as diesel? Geez, I'm no detective city councilor. Of my support for candidates whom dinosaur juice fuels, this environmentalist's a deflective city councilor. Channeling their voices through consultants' bank accounts, for-profit prisons require no corrective from this city councilor. With chamber video cameras trained on the forum lectern, sub rosa texting makes me a more connective city councilor. This Tuesday, public forums, too much forum for the public. Let's allocate funds to divert some invective from this city councilor. Learn to love what's mellow, T-town. Of a rotten bunch, I'm freshest. Precedent says ethics are elective in a city councilor.
Some very, very nice plays of language in that, which is the art of it. You have another one you'd like to read?
When I can't sleep at night, I often listen to podcasts, and I've lately been listening to podcasts by a fellow named Sean Carroll, who is a physicist who is an advocate of the many worlds theory or model of the universe, and not one that he came up with entirely on his own, but one that he's been a proponent of. Is that every time there's a quantum indeterminacy, the world is making a fork and it's turning into two different possibilities. And I was listening to that and thinking, like, well, boy, we're in an awfully messed up fork, you know. But that seemed like something to write about. So the multiverse. Each time a quantum decoherence hits, the world splits like packing tape before a fingernail, like shale hydraulically fractured by a proprietary blend of fracking fluids, like history. In one world, the cat is dead. In the other, he stretches upon wakening, his claws reaching like cedar roots. In another world, Trump is not orange. He is green, and he is not Trump, and he is not he. Madam President signs a carbon tax, and the world nods approvingly. How common sense that government would work for the common good. We turn down the thermostat and pull on a sweater. Everyone learns to knit. And in that other world, we rename the Port of Tacoma, the Puyallup Estuary. We plant eel grass all around and use our human cleverness to neutralize the poisons that came up with the dinosaur juice we left buried in one of reality's luckier forks. The tribe turns the LNG sarcophagus into a school for indigenous wisdom. In public school, children place their hand on their heart and recite the precautionary principle. After we knock down the ICE detention center, everyone in town carries a brick up the hill, and we talk for a long time about what design of homes would be most welcoming to those seeking refuge and to those carrying others to safety, and where the safest place would be to build as we ride out this time of rising waters.
Thank you very much, Bill. You have been listening to the multiversal poetry of Bill Kupinsa, and we thank you very, very much for all the poems you read. I'm sure that they'll find very willing ears to take to heart and mind.
Thank you so much for having me, David. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Sound Poetry on Radio Tacoma. I'm your host, David Gilmore.